kind of come this evening and share the word for us. And so you pray for him as he comes.
We'll be in Ecclesiastes chapter 7 tonight. Ecclesiastes chapter 7. I thought about talking to Gordon through the week when Pastor asked me to speak and getting together, and we'd just do a two-man performance of The Fiddler on the Roof to follow up with chapter 6. But I decided maybe we better not do that after all. And then I thought, well, I could at least get up here and sing If I Were a Rich Man and fulfill Pastor's wishes, but I didn't want to do that. So we're going to start in chapter 7 of Ecclesiastes. We'll read the chapter through together, and then we'll get into our study. In verse 1, a good name is better than precious ointments, and the day of death than the day of one's birth. It is better to go to the house of mourning than to go to the house of feasting, for that is the end of all men, and the living will lay it to his heart. Sorrow is better than laughter, for by the sadness of the countenance, the heart is made better. The heart of the wise is in the house of mourning, but the heart of fools is in the house of mirth. It is better to hear the rebuke of the wise than for a man to hear the song of fools, for as the crackling of thorns under a pot, so is the laughter of the fool. This also is vanity. Surely oppression maketh a wise man mad, and a gift destroyeth the heart. Better is the end of a thing than the beginning thereof, and the patient in spirit is better than the proud in spirit. Be not hasty in thy spirit to be angry, for anger resteth in the bosom of fools. Say not thou, what is the cause that the former days were better than these? For thou dost not inquire wisely concerning this. Wisdom is good with an inheritance, and by it there is profit to them that see the sun. For wisdom is a defense, money is a defense. But the excellency of knowledge is that wisdom giveth life to them that have it. Consider the work of God, for who can make that straight which he hath made crooked? In the day of prosperity be joyful, but in the day of adversity consider. God also hath set the one over against the other, to the end that man should find nothing after him. All things have I seen in the days of my vanity. There is a just man that perisheth in his righteousness, and there is a wicked man that prolongeth his life in his wickedness. And some curious words here. Be not righteous overmuch. Neither make thyself overwise. Why shouldest thou destroy thyself? Be not overmuch wicked. Neither be thou foolish. Why shouldest thou die before thy time? It is good that thou shouldest take hold of this. Yea, also from this withdraw not thine hand, for he that feareth God shall come forth of them all. Wisdom strengtheneth the wise more than 10 mighty men which are in the city, for there is not a just man upon earth that doeth good and sinneth not. Also take no heed unto all words that are spoken, lest thou hear thy servant curse thee. For oftentimes also thine own heart knoweth that thou thyself likewise hath cursed others. All this have I proven by wisdom. I said, I will be wise, but it was far from me. That which is far off and exceeding deep, who can find it out? I applied mine heart to know, and to search, and to seek out wisdom and the reason of things, and to know the wickedness of folly, even of foolishness and madness. And I find more bitter than death the woman whose heart is snares and nets, and her hands as bands. Whoso pleaseth God shall escape from her, but the sinner shall be taken by her. Behold, this have I found, saith the preacher, counting one by one to find out the account, which yet my soul seeketh, but I find not. One man among a thousand have I found, but a woman among all those have I not found. Lo, this only have I found, that God hath made man upright, but they have sought out many inventions. If you have your notes with you, you can get them in the back or on our website at our Connect page, lbcrichmond.com/connect. And we'll start there just with the introduction. Digging deep, ending empty. Ecclesiastes 7 under the sun, digging deep and ending empty. So you can tell it's going to be another cheerful night in the book of Ecclesiastes. Sun Tzu, Confucius, Buddha, Aristotle, Locke, Rousseau, Voltaire, Kant, and many other philosophers have mined the depths of human reason for answers. And through the ages, mankind's top men have spent their lives searching for the meaning of life. I always think of Indiana Jones on that one. We've got our top men on it. In previous chapters, the preacher offered ideals for wise living while confronting the hard realities of life under the sun. And now he's going to dig deeper, accepting the limits imposed by injustice, time, and death. He wrestles to find a purpose beyond pleasure, wealth, or companionship. His search is going to lead him to the noble pursuits of legacy and righteousness and a life wisely lived. But in the end, he concludes that the noble, enlightened path also leaves us empty and searching. So we're going to see a lot about wisdom again in this chapter, but there's a little bit of a different tenor to it than there had been earlier in the book. Many of the statements earlier in the book, and we'll see some in this chapter as well, deal with very practical applications of wisdom, things that seem to make sense. And now in chapter 7, he begins to apply wisdom even to move past the obvious to the things that seem contradictory. Many of these things that he's already pointed out, the inescapability of death, the fact that for the poor and the rich, things often end the same. For the wise and the foolish, there's no guarantee that one's actions will bring righteous living or bring benefits and blessings, and that the foolish action will bring sorrow. It's not a guarantee. He comes back and revisits many of these themes, but this time he attempts to dig down even deeper and apply, what if I just live a wise and enlightened life? What if I apply all of these things I've seen before to add to that wisdom? What if I approach the world and say, I know that things are not even. I've seen that things are not equal. I've seen that things don't always make sense, that the blessings don't always come to the good and the curses to the evil. And now that I've seen those things, how can I live wisely in light of those? And that's the search he seems to be giving us in chapter 7. And we start off with a series of passages in the first 12 verses or so that deal with these difficulties that deepen. Starting with verse 1, there's a better life and a virtuous reputation than precious ointment. And here, precious ointment could be simply anything rich and precious. We know precious ointment at that time was used as a very costly thing. It could be easily traded for wealth or for money. It would be a way to keep wealth or money, like we might even use gold in the same sense. We see that in other passages in the scripture. So we could take this very literally as a precious or pleasant scent coming from the perfume, or we could take this as precious and pleasant in that easy wealth that is to be had thereby. But in verse 1 it says, a good name is better than precious ointment. And we'd say this is starting like a lot of the passages before, right? This is standard wisdom kind of fare. This is something we'd expect to see in the Bible, right? A good name is more important than precious ointment. But it's setting up something bigger. It's setting up this contrast that we go through for the first 12 verses or so between a difficult thing to obtain and a thing that is immediately pleasant or delightful. And we see that in the second half of the verse when he totally kind of turns things on its head. And the day of death, then the day of one's birth. And suddenly we're left scratching our head. We started at the beginning of the verse. Yes, that makes sense. A good name is better than precious ointment. And the day of death, then the day of one's birth. I don't know about that one. I don't know if I'm ready for the day of death. A day of birth is a day of rejoicing. When someone we care for passes, this is a day of sorrow and a day of mourning. But we've set up this tension between things that are difficult to obtain but worth it and things that are immediately pleasant and delightful. And that's kind of the idea here with the day of death and the day of one's birth. And he's going to expound on that as we continue into the other verses with the idea that it's better to mourn than feast and laugh in verses 2 through 4. It's better to go to the house of mourning than to go to the house of feasting. Why? For that is the end of all men, and the living will lay it to his heart. Sorrow is better than laughter. Why? For by the sadness of the countenance, the heart is made better. And then he applies it directly to the heart in verse 4. He says, the heart of the wise is in the house of mourning. Notice it's not necessarily his physical being still reside in the house of mourning, but the heart of the wise man has taken the lessons from sorrow and from grief and applied them. And the heart of the fool is in the house of mirth. He's lived his life on the quickly passing, fleeting pleasures that can be had easily and readily. But here, the wise man dwells his heart in the house of mourning. So starting there with a good name is better than precious ointment, if we think about that name that is built throughout our life, the day of death better than the day of one's birth. It's hard to get a good name. It's hard to build it up over time. It's easy to lose it. And we've all probably known people who are dear to us who've passed on and seen the influence and impact of their lives after they've departed this life. I have a very personal experience with that myself. I've lived my life in the presence of a memory. My mother passed away when I was very young. She passed away when I was 8 years old. And I've lived life in the shadow of her memory. And that comes with a lot of different things. It's sometimes sorrow-filled. It's sometimes filled with difficulty. It's sometimes annoying when people come up to you and they want to tell you how they just know that your mother would have done things. But there's also something I've noticed through life, and that is the testimony of my mother. The name of my mother that goes on beyond her. It fits the context of our verse very well. The idea that the day of death is better than the day of one's birth is closely tied here in the verse to a good name. I've met people all my life. At first it was normal, right? Because she was a teacher, and I met people within the same school system that knew her. That made sense. And then I got older, and it had been years, and I met people in the community. And finally, I'm 20-plus years old, doing a local theater production and having sweet old ladies come up to me and say, "Oh, I knew your mother." Recognizing me by just my last name in a program, coming up, "Are you Marie Hass's son?" "Yes, I am." "Oh, I knew your mother," and telling me these wonderful things about my mother. A good name can live on well past us, but this is a difficult thing to obtain. As opposed to the day of one's birth, where there's immediate rejoicing, but a life ahead of it that's difficult. So we have the immediate delight versus the difficult thing. It's the same in a funeral versus a feast. In the funeral, as we contemplate that person's life, as we contemplate our own mortality, there can be great good brought about by that. Why? We see in verse 2, "Because for that is the end of all men, and the living will lay it to his heart." It reminds us all that we too will die. And because we will die, we ought to pay closer attention to how we live and who we live for. It often turns our mind to that. It can be of great good to our heart to look at the time of sorrow. And that's why he says sorrow is better than laughter, for by the sadness of the countenance, the heart is made better. And then the wise man is adjourned now in this difficult thing to look past the immediate delight and go to the difficult thing and say, here is the heart of mourning. I'm going to take it with me. Not that he can never be joyful, but that he has learned the lessons from death, from the funeral, from the despair, from the sorrow. It's caused him to stop and to pause and to consider his own life. And we continue with these sort of comparisons. It is better to hear the rebuke of the wise than for a man to hear the song of fools. So it's better to learn from correction and rebuke than to live an unexamined life of lax enjoyment, would be the idea here. If I go around and I just sing all day with nary a care in the world, you know, skipping around, whistling, and I will take my opportunities to sing to Pastor occasionally when he gets back if I were a rich man. It is, now that he's done it to all of us, it is a trick you can always count on. If you sing "If I Were a Rich Man" or just hum the first line around Pastor, it will be stuck in his head all day. So, just for you. This is not being recorded. It is. All right. So, we could go about singing all day and making our heart light and merry and without a care in the world. It's not the idea that we shouldn't do these things, but the picture is one of somebody who's doing this thoughtlessly, carelessly, joyfully, without worrying about anything else. And instead, we should live an examined life. When one rebukes us, particularly when a wise man rebukes us, we should take heed to it. We should correct our life. We should seek ways in which to make our name better. And he gives some more kind of details on this, verse 6. "For as the crackling of thorns under a pot, so is the laughter of the fool." It's short-lived. Instead of taking charcoal in the Far East, sometimes they would try to build a fire quickly and they would just take brambles and thorns. But the brambles and thorns would burn up before the pot could even get heated. There are other passages of Scripture that use the same illustration, that talk about before the flesh was heated in the pot. It's too quick. It's a fast flash burn. I would think about our fireplace at home, and the comparison that comes to my mind is when we're trying to start a fire with a whole bunch of paper bags, right? So we've got too many of them from Aldi, and you try to get the fire going with the paper bags, and it'll catch, and it'll blaze really hot for a second, but not long enough to heat much of anything. You've got to have something of substance in there. It says, the laughter of the fool is without substance. It's quick, it's fleeting, it's delightful in the moment, but ultimately not of great value. Surely oppression maketh a wise man mad, and a gift destroyeth the heart. We'll come back to that a little bit later. It's better to finish than to start. And we say, well, that makes sense, right? Verse 8, better is the end of a thing than the beginning thereof. The patient in spirit is better than the proud of spirit. That makes sense to us. I mean, it's good to finish what you start. But think again in terms of the difficult versus the delightful. It's not always easy to finish what you start. How many of us have a project at home that has just been kicking around for a very, very long time? Or three or four books that we're trying to read all at once? Right? Instead of the beginning. The beginning is so easy. It's exciting. And it's filled with hope. And there's lots of joy in starting something. And even sometimes a little bit of pride as we continue in verse 8. Better is the end of a thing than the beginning thereof. The patient in spirit is better than the proud in spirit. How many times have you ever met a child or maybe an adult who's just started something new, whether it's a new diet or a new activity, and we're ready to tell everybody about it? We haven't done much with it yet. We haven't accomplished much with it yet, but we're proud of what we've begun and we're excited about the possibilities. But the truth is that momentary fleeting joy may not amount to much. New Year's resolutions, anyone? They're coming up again. So instead, we compare it to the finished product. When you stick it through, this is a difficult thing. It takes effort. It takes time. But as we build, it is something ultimately worth more value. So in all these things, we see this continuing theme of wisely dealing with the difficult, going deeper than the immediately obvious. Not just I can be wise and it'll bring me blessings. I can be wise in these difficult things because it's good for me, like taking a dose of your medicine. And it's not always pleasant, but it's good for me. It will build me. And this is the life that Solomon is examining now. Maybe I find a path in this sort of life. And finally, it says, better the honest present than the gilded past. Say not thou, what is the cause that the former days were better than these? For thou dost not inquire wisely concerning this. The principled wise man confronts the problems of today rather than a utopia of memory. It's so easy for us to strip the past of its troubles and to replace it with a barren idealization. And oftentimes, as believers, we're quick to oppose those who seek a future perfection outside of Christ, who try to establish a kind of earthly, worldly utopia through their own means. And we say, ah, that's foolishness. But sometimes we do the same thing in the halls of our memory, where we erect monuments to past successes, where we take away the things that went wrong, where we strip away the bad memories and leave just the good things, and think of the bygone era and say, when things were wonderful. And the funny thing is, you don't have to be very far along in life to do it. If you've been around elementary kids, ever hear elementary kids reminisce about 2 or 3 years ago in school? Ah, the good old days with Mrs. So-and-so. Not the bad days now. Well, why is the days now so bad? Because there are difficulties in the present. Because it doesn't have the rosy glasses of memory to shade the hard times. The present is difficult. There are things that have to be handled and encountered and faced right now. The past is not so urgent. And we can look at it with rose-colored glasses. Better to have wisdom, verses 11 and 12 here. Wisdom is good with an inheritance, and by it there is profit to them that see the sun. There's value in wisdom, like wealth that can prepare you and for and protect you from the difficult things in life. Its value exceeds money because it can give life, is what we read in verse 12. For wisdom is a defense, money is a defense, but the excellency of knowledge is that wisdom giveth life to them that have it. Its value will exceed money. It gives life. Note the shift, though, in the language present in the verse. There's a shift that occurs from what we've seen before in the book of Ecclesiastes. In verse 11, there is profit to them that see the sun. Well, where have we been all this time in Ecclesiastes? We've been under the sun. And now he's looking, seeing the sun. Well, what is this life? Again, I think really in this passage of Scripture, Solomon is trying to dig past all these other things he's put together. In fact, later in our chapter, he's going to talk about laying one thing on top of another in his search for the wise life. So here's a difference between those living under the sun and the wise man who sees the sun. We can all live under the sun and live blissfully unaware. We might even live wisely, but without much consideration. We can do things that are wise and well thought of, but not give a lot of thought to them, just because that's what we've always done, just because we made a decision a long time ago that that's a good idea. But he views life with a higher awareness in this passage. The wise man in chapter 7 is asking questions. He's seeking answers. He's drawing conclusions. He's confronting the ambiguities and the contradictions that are present in life under the sun. And yet, he's still driven to disillusion. In verses 13 through 15, he says, "Consider the work of God, for who can make that straight, which he hath made crooked?" And we see that it's not that this is some sort of moral attack on God that he's made things crooked. No, instead, he's simply stating the reality as we see it, that our expectations are different than the world over which God is sovereign. And that sometimes that brings us a disillusioned sort of feeling. He's confronting what he's already hashed out in details many times. These expectations we have that good things come to good people, that bad things happen to bad people, that the righteous are rewarded, that the evil are punished, that wealth and money will produce happiness. All these things we've looked at in previous chapters. And he's confronting it more readily now and saying, who can make this straight? What God has made crooked. Not in the sense that God has done something morally wrong to make it crooked, but that God is sovereign over all of these things, but they don't meet my expectation. Compared to my expectation, things are out of kilter. They don't work the way I think they should work. Even a wise awareness of life's complexities can't deliver a full understanding. The best advice available under the sun is acceptance. That's where we find him in verses 13 through 15. Verse 14, in the day of prosperity, be joyful. But in the day of adversity, consider. God also has set the one over against the other, or he has set them next to each other. I was thinking about how we could illustrate that idea, and I thought, when I get ready in the morning with all of this, right, I set out beard oil, beard balm, beard brush, beard comb. It's much easier to shave, gentlemen. And all the things that I need. I set it out so I forget nothing in the steps because I'm that sort of person. I have a box where all my keys and my watch and my all of this stuff goes, my phone, or I will forget it. I set those things in a place. This is the same idea here, that he's set prosperous days before us, that God has also set grievous, adverse conditions before us. He set the one over against the other, to the end that man should find nothing after him. That man, not that man will find nothing after God, but the him refers back to man in this case. That man will find nothing past himself, meaning he doesn't know which one he's going to get in the next moment. There will be prosperity. Enjoy it. That's his conclusion. There will be adversity. Learn in it. Their presence is certain in life. But what he says here in verse 14 at the end of the verse is not certain, is we cannot know which will come next. Because we can't be certain that our actions will have any impact on the circumstances we encounter. So the things he's been dealing with previously. Money doesn't always bring security. Righteousness doesn't always bring blessing. Wickedness doesn't always bring cursing. Right? The things that we've looked at prior in the book, that life doesn't always work exactly how we think it should. That when we go through the book of Proverbs, these are ideals that often occur. But the world is twisted and things don't always work out that way. And so wisdom and righteousness don't necessarily have a reward. Verse 15 through 18 says, "All things have I seen in the days of my vanity. There is a just man that perisheth in his righteousness. There is a wicked man that prolongeth his life in his wickedness. Be not righteous overmuch, neither make thyself overwise. Why shouldest thou destroy thyself?" What's happening here? Don't be too righteous or too wise. What does that mean? Did he suddenly turn into Tevye? We should not view our righteousness or wisdom as guarantees of reward, blessing, or benefit. I think the question we're asking ourselves is, do we seek wisdom and righteousness with honest motives? Seeking to serve God, but expect fruit from our efforts rather than from his overwhelming goodness. This passage has three kind of popular interpretations for this portion of Scripture that we should be not righteous overmuch or make thyself overwise. One idea is kind of the idea of the golden mean, the idea that there's a good middle ground. You can be too righteous, you can be too wicked, you should just live in moderation, moderation all things, even wickedness and righteousness. The problem with that interpretation, besides the difficulties that it raises, but the other problem is it doesn't really fit in context. What's Solomon been talking about? He's been talking about shattered expectations, even leading up to in verse 15. "All things have I seen, the days of my vanity. There's a just man that perisheth, there's a wicked man that prolongeth." Before in verse 14, right? You don't know what's coming next. It could be prosperity, it could be adversity. And we have no way of knowing and no way of gauging and nothing to tell us what to expect. So it doesn't really fit the context, this idea of a golden mean that we're just supposed to be somewhere in the middle. Besides, if we pull in other passages, lukewarm and things like that. Then there's some people say, okay, well, maybe the passage means self-righteous, that we're not to be self-righteous. The biggest problem with that interpretation, though there's many things we can learn from it, and though we're certainly told not to be self-righteous in other places in Scripture, the biggest problem with applying it here is the Hebrew words involved are tzaddik and seder. And both of these words are used both in verse 15 and verse 16. The same words. So if we were going to read verse 16 as "be not self-righteous overmuch, neither make thyself overwise," we would also have to read in verse 15, "there is a just man that perisheth in his self-righteousness." Well, then this would not be something, this would not fit the context at all, right? It would not be talking about expectations. We'd just be like, yes, of course there's a just man that perisheth in his self-righteousness. He's being self-righteous. Right? There's the problem. But he uses the same word in both passages. So if we're going to accept in verse 15 that there is a just man that perisheth in his righteousness, then we have to accept in verse 16 that we're not to be righteous overmuch. So then what is meant? Well, a third interpretation that I think is perhaps the closest here is the idea of, yes, it's genuine righteousness. So what type of righteousness? Well, it's this idea of expectations being continued over in this passage. Do we live our lives expecting that our righteous deeds, that our wise actions should bring certain results from God? And so, well, that sounds like self-righteousness. I think there's a careful difference I want to make between the two, and it's mostly in intention and focus. It digs a little deeper into the problems of our heart than self-righteousness. We can catch self-righteousness and maybe miss this one. We can catch when we're being self-righteous. We can feel the flow of conviction come upon us when we have to decide that, oh, I am basing everything off my behaviors and actions. Sometimes a step deeper than that is what's maybe being discussed here. The idea that I can be completely honest in my intention. That I can desire to serve God righteously. I can desire to live my life with wisdom. I can try to do things in the right way with every intention of serving God through it and with every knowledge and belief that it's not my own efforts that will produce results. And yet, how easily and quickly we slip from that to relying on what we're doing rather than on God's goodness. How quickly do we slip with this question here? Do we seek wisdom and righteousness with honest motives many times? Seeking to serve God, yes, but then are we disappointed when there's not fruit from our efforts? Or do we expect that things will change with my actions only? Can we ever expect good of God when I do evil? I would say yes. Because in that while I was yet a sinner and an enemy of God, Christ died for me and for all of us. We're sometimes flabbergasted by that idea that when I'm at my worst, God would still reach out to me because we get so ingrained in our mind, though we are honest in our intentions and our desire to serve God. It becomes so ingrained in us that I am doing these things to serve Him. And when I do these things to serve Him, He will bless me. And when I don't do these things to serve me, He will curse me. And our reliance slowly shifts without any intention towards self-righteousness, with every intention to serve Him honestly. And it shifts to putting the onus on my efforts and not on what He's done on the cross. As if I could make things any better by my actions, as if I could force Him or cause Him to love me more than He did when He died for me, when I was fallen and completely away from Him and an enemy of Him. So that's perhaps the idea. This genuine righteousness that expects a certain result from God for our righteousness, that expects a certain result from God for our wisdom. On the flip side, do we as Christians get upset when our righteousness doesn't yield good result? When we find ourselves in the hard moment, though I've been living well, when we find ourselves with the difficult decision, the bank account that gets wiped out when I've done everything properly and wisely, the sickness that comes when I served God faithfully, and we question. And he says, don't be over-righteous. We cannot expect from our righteousness, we cannot expect from God for our righteousness and wisdom a return. So then he kind of turns to wisdom for wisdom's sake, and we get back to some practical wisdom here in verses 19 through 22. Verse 19 says, wisdom strengtheneth the wise more than 10 mighty men which are in the city. For there is not a just man upon earth that doeth good and sinneth not. Also take no heed unto all words that are spoken, lest thou hear thy servant curse thee. For oftentimes also thine own heart knoweth that thou thyself likewise hath cursed others. How many times have you had a movie or book plot on that one? Where the person can suddenly read people's thoughts or has super hearing, so they heard the thing that they weren't supposed to hear, that the person said about them, that their best friend said about them, and now they're disappointed. Right. It's right here with Solomon. Hey, don't try to listen too closely. You may hear your servant say bad things about you. But when you do, remember, you kind of do the same thing to other people, don't you? So there's a wisdom and righteousness now that he's bringing out that doesn't expect reward. Right? Wisdom for wisdom's sake. If being wise doesn't ensure benefits, why seek wisdom? And he echoes some of his earlier thoughts from verse 11 and 12 in this. Because wisdom gives stability. Because wisdom gives strength. Because wisdom can see oppression clearly. If we look back at verse 7, surely oppression maketh a wise man mad, and a gift destroyeth the heart. There's a question in that verse that scholars argue about. Is it oppression from the wisdom? Is it oppression by the wise man? Or is it oppression to the wise man that causes him this trouble? And we don't know the answer. Maybe it's a little bit of both when we look at this passage here later in the chapter. As it says, for oftentimes also thine own heart knoweth that thou thyself likewise hath cursed others. So he says, hey, you can't expect. There's a certain graciousness in it, right? Wisdom gives stability and strength. It sees oppression clearly and then graciously without personal bias. It looks at others who oppress and says, yes, but I also oppress others. Right? It looks at it and says, that's the wise way to take it, maybe in reference to verse 7, that prevents you from entering into the problem of verse 7, that oppression maketh a wise man mad, and a gift destroyeth the heart. That here in verse 7, right, which one is it? Is it that the wise man's being oppressed, or is it that the wise man is doing the oppressing? maybe some of both. And maybe part of the wisdom is the recognition that though I am sometimes oppressed, I shouldn't let it push me to foolishness, because there's a balance here, because, yeah, oppression is something that even the just man does. It says, for there's no just man who sinneth not, and I'm not one either. I also oppress. So the wisdom in it is looking at myself when I look at others and saying, I mess up, so when they do something that's wrong to me, I have to bear that in mind. Then we have a frustrating search that Solomon enters into here at the end of the chapter. So he's looking for this different type of wisdom. And he says, all this have I proved by wisdom. He's digging deeper in this chapter. He's acknowledging all the things that he's seen before, the unfairnesses, the things that don't quite make sense, and still trying to apply wisdom to them and seeing if he can squeeze out from that turnip, right, a little bit of goodness. If he can still find the good life by living the wise life in the middle of all the things in life that don't make sense. And he said, I said, I will be wise, but it was far from me. And verse 24, we're asked another big question. That which is far off and exceeding deep, who can find it out? I applied mine heart to know and to search and to seek out wisdom and the reason of things, and to know the wickedness of folly, even of foolishness and madness. I want to look a little bit more deeply at his search, because there's some controversy here. I don't want to deal with it too much tonight. It's not the point that we're focused on. But as you read through the verses earlier, read through the chapter, it may have struck you too, some things said about a woman here that some would look at and say, well, this is wrong. This is a negative view of women in Scripture. And so there's some things that we'll look at. It's been dealt with from this pulpit before in the past, but we'll quickly look at just a couple things. First off, we can point out the contents of his search. What is he searching for? He said, I applied mine heart to know and to search. To do what? To seek out wisdom and the reason of things, to know the wickedness of folly, even of foolishness and madness. And then he says he had some other findings. He found more bitter than death a woman whose heart is snares and nets, and her hand is bands. Whoso pleaseth God shall escape from her, but the sinner shall be taken by her. And say, well, what's he talking about here? Well, if we take this as Solomon writing, it could well be he's looking at his own life, right? And he's seen some of the choices that he has made, the sort of company that he has kept. And he's commenting on it. It could be like in Proverbs that he's commenting on the danger of certain types of companionship, that they can pull someone astray. The problem comes when sometimes in verse 27 we add this together. We say, behold, this have I found, saith the preacher, counting one by one to find out the account. Well, the question is, what does this and account apply to? And we really don't know for sure. If we apply it back to verse 26, we do get something that doesn't read so great for a viewpoint of the woman in general, or women in general. But there's no need to read it as applying to verse 26. I would say it applies more aptly to verse 25, because he's searching for what? Wisdom, the reason of things, wickedness of folly, foolishness, and madness. And then he starts telling us some of his findings. So there's the contents of the search, and then he begins to carefully count the results. So he's counting one by one to find the account as he searches for the wise way. And he says, which yet my soul seeketh, but I find not. So he's still seeking, and has he found what he's seeking for? In verse 25. Nope. This is the wisest man who ever lived. Well, what about the rest of the verse? It says, one man among a thousand have I found. Well, he's found a wise man. This could be he's taking a poll. It could be quite literally he's taking a poll. It could be figurative language to give the idea of a vast scope. But the phrase, but a woman among all these have I not found, does not mean that there are no wise women. It simply means I looked diligently, and he doesn't have a lot good to say about anybody. He doesn't have much good to say about the men either. He found one man who appeared to be pretty wise, but did he find the ultimate wisdom that he's looking for? No, not even for himself. Behold this. So what did he find? What was his wise finding? Verse 29, "Lo, this only have I found, that God hath made man upright. But they have sought out many inventions." He said, "I've searched everywhere. I've polled people. I've talked to many people. I found one guy who seemed pretty wise, but still I've not found the thing that I seek. The real meaning, the real reason, the real wisdom behind it all. The wisdom that brings me to a world that finally makes sense, that takes even the things that don't make sense and says, if I live a wise life, a considered life, a thoughtful life, attacking even the difficult things, then now I will finally understand. And I've not found that. Found one man who's pretty wise, and that's about it. And so what did I find instead? That man has many inventions or schemes. This is the word we could use there for it. So his search leads him to conclude that though God made man without corruption, man sought many schemes. So even his noble quest for wisdom has to be marked as flawed. And worse yet, its best efforts often corrupt and pull man from the source of wisdom in the first place. Because what does he say? God made man upright, uncorrupted. They've sought out many schemes. And in this quest for philosophical wisdom, for an understanding, even taking into account the negative things and the bad things and the things that don't make sense, and I'll still try to order it and understand it, it just pulls me further sometimes from my God. So that's a depressing ending. So let's add a little bit of hope to it. Turn with me, if you will, to Isaiah 40. I want to address two questions that we saw earlier. First, in verse 13, "Consider the work of God, for who can make that straight which he hath made crooked?" And in verse 24, "That which is far off and exceeding deep, who can find it out?" And you may read, as I did, that verse about crooked and think, ah, I know. Every valley shall be exalted, and every mountain and hill shall be made low, and the crooked shall be made straight, and the rough places plain, and I'll spare you singing the portion of Messiah, the aria from Handel. But yes, there it is. The crooked will be made straight by Christ. But and I wanted to go there. I really did. And then I went to Isaiah chapter 40, verse 3, and you start reading, and it's not necessarily that Christ is coming to make things straight. This is a prophecy about a message that's going to happen. So as we dig out this evening and hopefully get to some happier ground, it's understanding the deep and straightening the crooked. And first, Isaiah 43 is the messenger that we see. "The voice of him that crieth in the wilderness, prepare ye the way." Isaiah is being called as a messenger. Later, these verses are applied by Christ to John the Baptist in Luke 3 and also in the book of Matthew, where he says, here's the guy that Isaiah prophesied about who'll come and prepare the way for the Messiah by doing what? Well, the imagery that's given here to make the crooked straight, the rough places plain, the valleys exalted, the mountains and hills made low. This was a thing that was actually done in the ancient world by monarchs. As monarchs came through and traveled through distant lands, they would sometimes, if they were wealthy enough and powerful enough, as some emperors were, they would have those travel in front of them and literally fill in valleys to make a smoother road. Literally build bridges, make paths through mountains to make a smoother road. So what is this smoother road that's going to happen? We actually have it in Isaiah 43. It's the messenger who's going to be preaching this message, prepare ye the way, make smooth the way for the Messiah, for Christ. So it's an illustration of preparation that we see in 4 and 5, not quite the Messiah just yet. But though it's not as direct, I think it's just as good in its context. So verse 6, he asks, well, what message should I bring? The voice said, cry. And he said, what shall I cry? He said, here's your message. All flesh is grass, and all the goodliness thereof is as the flower of the field. The grass withereth, the flower fadeth, because the Spirit of the Lord bloweth upon it. Surely the people is grass. So the first part of the message, man is frail. And then the second part of the message, God is true. The grass withereth, verse 8, the flower fadeth, but the word of our God shall stand forever. God is true, man is frail. Here's the message. O Zion, that bringest good tidings, get thee up into the high mountain. O Jerusalem, that bringest good tidings, lift up thy voice with strength. Lift it up, be not afraid. Say unto the cities of Judah, behold your God. God redeems. And as we go through, I want to just conclude the message by reading the remainder of Isaiah 40. But I'm going to point out a couple verses particularly that deal with exactly the two questions we ask. Who's going to make the crooked straight? And who can know the deep things? So verse 10, who's going to make the crooked straight? Behold, the Lord God will come with strong hand, and his arm shall rule for him. Behold, his reward is with him, and his work before him. He shall feed his flock like a shepherd. He shall gather the lambs with his arm and carry them in his bosom, and shall gently lead those that are with young. Who's mighty enough to make the crooked straight? Who hath measured the waters in the hollow of his hand and meted out heaven with the span and comprehended the dust of the earth in a measure, weighed the mountains in scales, the hills in a balance? Who hath directed the spear of the Lord, or being his counselor hath taught him? Who can know the deep things? With whom took he counsel, and who instructed him and taught him in the path of judgment and taught him knowledge and showed him to the way of understanding? Who's strong enough to make the crooked straight? Behold, the nations are as a drop of a bucket and are counted as the small dust of the balance. Behold, he taketh up the isles as a very little thing. And Lebanon is not sufficient to burn, nor the beast thereof sufficient for a burnt offering. All nations before him are as nothing, and they are counted to him less than nothing and vanity. To whom then will ye liken God? Or what likeness will ye compare unto him? The workman melteth a graven image, and the goldsmith spreadeth it over with gold and casteth silver chains. He that is so impoverished that he hath no oblation chooseth a tree that will not rot. He seeketh unto him a cunning workman to prepare a graven image that shall not be moved. Who's wise enough to know the deep things? Have ye not known? Have ye not heard? Hath it not been told you from the beginning? Have ye not understood from the foundations of the earth? It is he that sitteth upon the circle of the earth, and the inhabitants thereof are as grasshoppers, that stretcheth out the heavens as a curtain, spreadeth them out as a tent to dwell in, that bringeth the princes to nothing. He maketh the judges of the earth as vanity. Yea, they shall not be planted, yea, they shall not be sown, yea, their stock shall not take root in the earth, and he shall also blow upon them, they shall wither, and the whirlwind shall take them away as stubble. To whom then will ye liken me, or shall I be equal? Saith the Holy One. Lift up your eyes on high, and behold, who hath created these things that bringeth out their host by number? He calleth them by all names by the greatness of his might, for that he is strong in power, not one faileth. Why sayest thou, O Jacob, and speakest, O Israel, my way is hid from the Lord, and my judgment is passed over from my God? Who can know the deep things? Hast thou not known? Hast thou not heard that the everlasting God, the Lord, the creator of the ends of the earth, fainteth not, neither is weary? There is no searching of his understanding. He giveth power to the faint. To them that have no might, he increaseth strength. Even the youth shall faint and be weary. The young men shall utterly fall. But they that wait upon the Lord shall renew their strength. They shall mount up with wings as eagles. They shall run and not be weary. They shall walk and not faint. Is there wisdom that we can grasp, even in the deeper things, though we are to recognize all the failures of life, though we are to be ever so conscientious and erudite, ever so scholarly, ever so considered in our life and our lifestyle, can we find hope in that? No. Solomon says no. But who can make the crooked straight? Even this God who is so powerful. Who can make? Who can know the deep things? The one who knows all. And so we end there this evening with a little bit of joy digging us out. Who can fix the crooked? God can. Christ can. Who can know the deep things?